everyone. Welcome to the 289th episode of the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a gadget-filled plus an enterprise IoT-filled show for you today. We're going to be talking about the latest IoT signals report from Microsoft, a continuation of a deal that Microsoft signed with Rockwell Automation. We've got some updates on the ARM NVIDIA acquisition, plus NVIDIA has a new AI kit for, we'll call it, the industrial people. We've also got some security news, including our old friend Telnet, and tons of gadgets. So we've got some news from Wyze. I tested out some products from Philips and Nest. And we've got some other fun tidbits for you. Plus, we're going to hear from Mike Cirelli, the VP of Marketing at Ecolab. And Ecolab is a company that does water processing for manufacturers and the like. And they've got two things, a 25-year-old IoT sensor and Microsoft HoloLens that's helping them through the pandemic. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to hear from this week's sponsor, Perceive, and another one of our sponsors. We're switching things up with Very. So let's get to it. This message is sponsored by Very, which is creating the 2021 Best of the Smart Home Awards. So if you are ready to win validation, recognition, and visibility for your smart home product, you should apply now for the 2021 Best of the Smart Home Awards at bestofthesmarthome.com. This is going to get your product in the hands of judges like me. Ta-da! And Rob Tiffany, who is the VP of IoT Strategy at Ericsson. You can apply at bestofthesmarthome.com. And I encourage you to apply today. You do not have to have a relationship with Very to actually apply. So get to it, y'all. Okay, that's going to be a lot of fun, Kevin. I'm kind of excited because I'm going to get all these. I'm hopeful that they're going to be cool products. So, yay. And you know how judgy I am. I love judging things.
I think I know that more than anybody, yes.
Yes. Kevin, what did you mean by that? I don't agree. All right, let's get started with some news from the enterprise world. Every year, Microsoft does the IoT Signals Report, but really, this is only the second year. They do several of these, but this is the big, like, hey, who in enterprise is using IoT and how many of them are doing it? So this year, they interviewed people. It was March and April of this year, so right as the pandemic was happening, and apparently 91% of global IoT decision makers have adopted the IoT, which is up from 85% last year. What's not surprising is only a quarter of those have deployed projects, and the rest are 29% are in the learning stage. Yeah, yeah. 25% are in the trial proof of concept phase. 21% are actually purchasing. So yay.
It seems like these numbers are the same every year. It's always like a quarter of them are in this phase of maybe deployment or learning or what.
Yeah. We are moving a little bit further. Like, I feel like last year there were fewer in the actual use phase, way more in the trial phase. Because remember, last year we were still in pilot purgatory. And perhaps for people who are building these solutions or even adopting it, Microsoft's research is showing that the time to use is roughly 12 months. So that's actually kind of a long time. So, you know, you're going to invest in this. They broke it down by regions. China is the fastest. In China, you can get this thing to use in 10 months. In the US, it's 11. And in Germany, it is 14. So, most companies do plan to use more IoT. It's about two-thirds. So, yay. And again, this isn't going to surprise anybody. The IoT adopters who are actually using the technology are, you know, manufacturing, healthcare, retail, and energy. So those are our big areas where people are doing it. COVID-19 has pushed a third of the respondents to say they're going to invest more in IoT. This makes sense because a lot of, like, most of the pitches I'm getting around use of IoT right now and post-COVID and just in general, prior to this, it was mostly asset tracking and tracking, not even predictive maintenance, just monitoring your equipment. Now we're seeing a lot more with remote access and helping people who can't get into a physical manufacturing space, being able to still get information about it or help people on the ground. You're actually going to hear about that in our interview. So 31% are going to invest more because of COVID. 41% are going to keep things the same. And 16% are going to invest less because there's a pandemic on, y'all. They talked about the reasons for IoT adoption. Safety and security is the top reason, but it's not like employer safety. It's actually IT security and safety. This is more like tracking people walking around secured areas of the building. This isn't like tracking people for pandemic-related reasons. The other thing that I thought, because, you know, I love sustainability and talking about that. A third of people are using it, IoT, for sustainability, but most of those are people in other countries. So it's not here in the U.S.,
Boo. Which is,
yeah, I was a little sad about that. It's a less common measure of success. The most common measure of success for your IoT efforts are going to be cost efficiency. Yay. Or a boost in quality, or which could be a decrease in human errors, which will save you money, and also production efficiency. So all of these really boil down to money. The less common measures of success, which is where I would love to see us go, is more informed decision making and creating new product innovations and sustainability. So we're not there yet, which is kind of a bummer. Challenges to using more IoT, because Microsoft's like, let us sell you more, and good for them. Most of them are like, hey, we're still chewing what we swallowed. What is that? Biting off what we can chew, chewing what we bit off. I am terrible today with metaphors, but
they're using everything right now that they can.
Right. So 33% are still implementing their current solutions. 31% are working out existing challenges. There's also like 28% have no budget and no people. Complexity is still an issue. A full fifth don't want to store their data in the public cloud. So bring on the edge. All right. There's a lot more data in here. I will link to this both in the newsletter this week and also in the show notes. So you should check that out because there is tons of useful information. And I actually like these reports. And Microsoft throughout the rest of the year will break out various industries as well, which is always fun. Speaking of Microsoft, they continued their partnership with Rockwell Automation. We're seeing a lot of these. And basically, Rockwell Automation is really good with the industrial world, the OT side of things, as it were. So teaming up with Microsoft is just going to help make that just a little bit more seamless. It's not new, it's not that exciting, but it's good that that's working out for them. And yeah, I don't really have more to say about that. So let's move on to exciting news. Also, actually, this is probably exciting for more of the industrial people because this is a really popular product there. NVIDIA has a new Jetson Nano AI kit. Tell us about it, Kevin.
Yes, it is new. It is small. It has 2 gig of memory. You can have it for just $59, which is really cheap compared to the old developer kit, which I believe was more in the...
$99.
Oh, okay.
They had a $99 one, and then they had one that was more expensive.
I'm thinking of the more expensive. It was still under $1,000, but it was, you know...
Oh, yeah, that was a ginormously fat...
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you could train on that or what, but it was impressive.
I don't know. But this is small. This is the Jetson Nano Developer Kit. Looks very similar to, say, to a Raspberry Pi, although it's a square board instead of a rectangular board. It has a 128-core NVIDIA Maxwell GPU, which is not the most current GPU product line they have. Ampere is the current one that they just rolled out in the last month or so. But still, there's plenty of horsepower here, along with the...
I've got a giggle, Kevin. Ampere, current. Ah! Okay.
Oh, that's funny.
Okay, I'm
that's
sorry.
Funny.
I distracted that's all right. You were already losing your point. Keep going.
I was, because I wanted to get the name of their SDK that comes with it. And I can't remember what it is. I think it's Jetpack or not. It's something along the lines of Jetson. In any case, you get the hardware, you get the software, it runs Linux, and you've got multiple USB ports and so on. But really, this is for AI. This is for training models on a small scale. Tinkerers would like this. You're right. Perhaps industrial people who are developing products and so
it's on. It's actually one of the most popular. The older $99 NVIDIA Jetson stick was one of the most popular boards for industrial IoT. It was people picking it up to train and play. I don't know if they were training or they were just running their models on it inside the factories, but that's what it was. It was prototyping for AI and factory use cases, and they loved it. People love that stuff.
Well, not only that, besides having the history of having these products out for a while, they have some really excellent tutorials. I looked at some of the getting started things that they have, the videos, found out that you can use the new Raspberry Pi camera module with this. You can use a USB camera with this, whatever you'd like. But they're very supportive to the developer community, is what I'm saying.
Yes. And along that note, ARM just did their TechCon developer event virtually this week. That is happening. Some good content, but there was an interview between Simon Segars, the CEO of ARM, and Jensen Huang, who is the CEO of NVIDIA. And they answered some questions. And a couple things that I had been wondering that I thought maybe I should tell y'all is they asked about, hey, NVIDIA makes GPUs. ARM makes GPUs, their Mali GPU family. Both are going to stay. Jensen's like, yeah, we're going to keep doing both because, you know, my GPUs are not for everything. And he's right. And the big reason this deal is happening, and I'm going to go direct quote, Jensen says, we want to be the computing company for the age of AI. And to do that, the thesis is they need ARM because NVIDIA has been a specialty processor on the GPU side forever. And even as far as 10 years ago, you know, I was going into NVIDIA and seeing their silicon and they were trying to get into smartphones. They actually bought a radio company for a while and it just didn't work. And with ARM getting into the data center and NVIDIA seeing the demand for AI workloads, this is a real opportunity. So I encourage you, if you're a developer who cares about this sort of thing, you know, you can go watch that chat, perhaps. But this is an interesting deal. And I'm actually a little bit more excited than I was beforehand. So I guess their whole dev conference worked for me anyway. Okay, there's like a new research center and all this other stuff, but it's not really related to the IoT. So I'm not going to talk about it. Instead, we're going to talk about, oh, a security flaw. Oh, Kevin, let's talk about it.
Yet another one that was discovered this week by NetLab, who published a report. I wouldn't panic just yet over this, but basically there is a early stage bit of malware that is being spread around to routers and IoT devices that use Telnet. And I'm not going to say any more there because we all know how we feel about Telnet. Don't use it.
Bad.
Bad. At this point, the researchers can't tell if this is just poorly written code or if it's not fully developed yet. But what they see in the code is the capability or potential capability for this botnet to literally wipe all the storage, all the drives and disks on any router or IoT device that gets infected. Now, they're not sure if that's the intent of it or if it is a self-destruct type of command to basically clean itself off after it propagates. I do not know. They do not know. I wouldn't worry just yet, but boy, oh boy, Telnet. Stop using it.
Yeah, please. Because, yeah, nothing good comes from Telnet.
It's not secure.
All right. Speaking of other things we wouldn't want to have connected to Telnet, we wouldn't want to leave an open Telnet port on. I'm not even going to touch this story. You can. We have to because everyone's talking about it.
Okay. So the long and short of it, because I don't want to dwell on this too long, is that there is a smart chastity device for men. I will let you imagine how it prevents sexual acts, but it is connected. That's the more important thing. And there are some programming interface flaws that let attackers remotely lock your private parts into this. And I mean, this kind of strikes me as a twist on ransomware where like somebody takes over your computer and you can't get your data till they unlock it after you sent them Bitcoin. Theoretically, somebody could not let you unlock this from your private parts until you send them Bitcoin or whatever. I don't know.
I feel like something like this should have like a kill switch, like a physical kill switch.
Let's not use kill when discussing these parts.
Sorry.
Let's use an unlock switch.
I just, you know, like when we start thinking about applying connectivity to devices, we really need to think of all of the threat models. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially something that you attach to yourself, to a physical body part.
Yeah. So I feel like this is a good opportunity to remind people that security isn't one size fits all. And when you build a physical device that has certain characteristics, it's worth thinking about what happens if this gets hacked. Just like it's worth thinking about what happens if I can't pay my cloud costs and this thing needs to, it's like graceful degradation, but it's also like graceful degradation under attack.
The service is shut down. There's an interruption and you're locked in. And I really can't believe you said one size fits all in this segment. That's what I'm going to say there.
It's because my brain doesn't work. Moving on. Let's talk about devices, family-friendly devices. Wyze, the thermostat. Wyze is on their product roll. So they've got their thermostat out now. And we mentioned this, but you can pre-order it for $49.99. And, you know, it looks like a Wyze device. I don't know how, I mean, it's like a little oblong oval thing with, looks just like their doorbell and their lock, actually.
Standard Wyze design language for sure. I do like the fact that it has, I mean, it's got a screen, it's got a knob. I like the user interface where it's kind of like a radio dial rounded and you just turn the heat up or down and whatnot, if you do it manually, of course.
Yes. I've got the Ecobee 3 or 4, and I actually don't like the fact that there's no knob. It's a touch screen and you just scroll it up and down. And I mean, it's not awful.
I have the same thing and I like it. But to be honest, more often than not, I'm using voice than anything else to control it.
Yeah, I didn't set mine up with voice because of reasons. We'll have a slow week and we'll talk about Stacey's smart home drama. It'll happen. Okay, I have purchased many things, not the Wyze thermostat, but I did buy the Philips Hue 100 watt equivalent A21 LED dimmable smart wireless light bulb. Oh, so many words. Basically, it's Philips Hue super white bright bulb. And I bought this because I live in Seattle and it will start eventually getting dark at like 4:30 in the afternoon. And I have no overhead lights, no lights at all in my living room if I don't bring them in. And all of my lights were just so dim, y'all. So I bought these and they are bright. Most Philips Hues are the equivalent of like a 60 watt bulb, and I would call it a dim 60, honestly. This is 1600 lumens and it is warm and you cannot change the color temperature. So this is just one white for all of time. And that white is a warm white. It's 2700 Kelvin. So that is on the warmer end of things and it is bright. I noticed an immediate difference putting them in. I put them in two places, and because it's warm light, it didn't strike me as too bright, I guess, but I appreciate them. And they are Bluetooth. Hue and Amazon have done a great job working together because the second I put these in, the Hue figured it out and asked me to name it and stuff like that. But I also got a notification on my Madam A app that was like, hey, I just discovered a new Hue bulb. And it was using Bluetooth, I think, to discover it. I'm using the Hue Hub because I have one, but this is a Bluetooth capable light. So you could have up to 10 Bluetooth capable Hues and control them from your Google Nest or your Amazon Echo or your phone.
And these are, I think, $20 each?
Yes, that is the thing. They're $19.99. They're kind of pricey, but it's Philips Hue.
I kind of wish you could tune the color.
I do too. I totally do. But I just needed something. Gosh, it was so dark. So dark.
We have like no overhead lights in our homes. It's all lamps. So I sympathize.
And I know that, you know, all the designers are like, oh, you don't want overhead lights. It's so not, what's that Danish word for cute? Hyg, hug, hig? I don't know. Anyway.
Okay. IKEA. I don't know.
Yeah. Just ignore me. All right. The other thing is I got a review unit of the new Nest Audio and it's adorable, y'all. And I got it in pink. Oh, they call it sand. My studio, if y'all don't know this, is pink. So, or technically it's called First Light. It is by Benjamin Moore, but it's pink. And the Nest Audio works with this, but y'all don't want to know about the pink. Y'all want to know how it sounds. And it sounds really good. Google did a wonderful presentation where they talked about what they were trying to achieve with the sound. The bottom line is they didn't want to resort to like weird compression tricks. They wanted to really have a large dynamic range and allow you to hear everything. This is, I guess, AI modulated. You know, we have computational photography. Do we have computational sound now?
I would say so. I mean, just based on placing speakers in the right place of a room, such as the Sonos, for example. Absolutely.
So it sounds really good. It sounds way better than the Google Home, which sounded like crap. It also sounds better than my older Echo devices. I want to try the Echo Studio in my house. I have heard the Echo Studio, obviously, when they launched it in 2019, but it probably doesn't sound as good as the Google Nest Max, the giant big speaker.
Home Max.
Home Max.
Yep.
because that has a lot more speaker capability. But Google also said that people didn't want to buy it because it was too big. And I appreciate that. It does not sound as good as my old Sonos Play 5, but that is an ancient speaker and it's designed as a speaker and it's big. So,
well, this is also a $99 speaker. And I'm not going to say that price determines sound quality, but
it's true.
You know,
it's okay. Yeah, so like, it's $99, but it's also like it's almost 7 inches tall and almost 5 inches wide. So it's tiny. It is pretty heavy for the size. It's 2.6 pounds, which is always good. Every time I pick up a speaker, I'm like, oh, I'm like, all right. So a couple things to note for our listeners who are crazy about Wi-Fi and smart home stuff. This does have 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi. So this is dual band Wi-Fi, 2.4 and 5 gigahertz, which is nice. It picks up my voice really well. And on my Google displays, I've had a hard time getting it to shut up to listen to me when music is playing. I didn't have that problem on this speaker, which was nice. Google says that it adapts to noise in the room. And it told me to like bring an electric toothbrush near and see what I heard and turn on the vent fan over my stove and see what I heard. I did all of these things and I heard no change.
I wonder if, because these can be paired or be whole home audio, I wonder if you had two of those in the same room, if that would make a difference in terms of that background noise.
Yeah, I don't know. And it's got capacitive controls on the top. So would you, should you buy this speaker? I'm going to buy two of these and I'm going to buy the Echo Studio. I'm hoping it goes on sale for Prime Day. That's what I'm waiting for because I spend a lot on gadgets. So I'm probably going to buy two of these and then one of those, see which one sounds better in my big open area and then put that there. And then if it's the Echo Studio, I will move the speakers. I will split the pair, move one into my office and I don't know, maybe I'll move two into my office. I don't know.
See, this is the problem.
I'll give one away on the show.
Yeah, there you go. I have so many of the Nest Minis and the Nest Smart Displays that I would be replacing speakers if I bought these. And I guess for somebody who has maybe the Minis and you want more sound, it sounds like if you want to drop $99, you could retire a Mini or reuse it somewhere else. I don't think I'm going to replace anything with these, so I'm not going to buy one.
Yeah, if you don't need one, I just need better sound because all I have, well, and this is so embarrassing. Actually, it's kind of good. I still have my original Echo that I bought in 2014 and it still works.
Hey, I have a Zune, so don't be embarrassed.
Your Zune doesn't still work.
Oh yeah, Zune still works.
Okay.
With local music? Sure it does.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Oh yeah.
All right. So that's the Nest speaker. And, you know, if you're all in on Google, this is a good deal. It's comparable to the brand new Echo, which I haven't tried yet because it's not available yet. So that would be the comparable product at both the price point and probably everything else. Okay. And speaking of Google and Google Assistant, which is available on the Nest speaker, Kevin?
Yeah, so I did not know this, but this month is International Augmentative and Alternative Communication Awareness Month. And as a result, Google has brought the Google Assistant to Tobii Dynavox products. These are kind of like kiosk-y or single-purpose tablets. And what this means is basically Google has brought Google Assistant for folks who may not be able to speak or may not be able to reach out and touch a screen and so on and so forth. So what this has done is it brings the ability to create custom tiles that people with disabilities can interact with through eye gaze or scanning or touch if they can touch. So it's bringing Google Assistant to many, many more people in what I think is a very underserved community here.
That is awesome. And I think the opportunity with a lot of our technology, it has opened up doors for people who have historically been shut out of the world.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember just as far back as, I mean, talking to my uncle who is deaf, we had a TTY, which was like this old school telephone that on a keyboard kind of thing. And, you know, the second Skype came out, he was like, boom, I'm on it. And same with the smart home. The second we started getting things like, he had expensive tools that were custom designed for the deaf community that turned lights on when the doorbell rang and that sort of thing. But now we all have that. And the benefits are there's a lot more variability and it's cheaper. I'm glad this is happening.
Same.
All right, let's talk about backpacks. I know, what? Backpacks? Jacquard. I feel like we've talked about it so much, but Jacquard is the smart fabric that Google created in its ATAP program, the fancy, fancy technology that's crazy. Also, its gesture-controlled ultra-wideband technology solely is from that. So Jacquard is the smart fabric. They put it in a jean jacket that was super expensive, and then they also announced a backpack. And this is a backpack made with the fabric, and you get a little tiny tag that converts the pressure and the feedback from the fabric into something your smartphone can work with. And you can use this backpack to, you touch the straps and you can like, you can turn your music on, turn the volume up, turn the volume down. You can answer calls. It's pretty cool. And you can customize the gestures that go with actions. So they talked about like triggering a selfie, although then every picture of you would have you with the backpack on, which...
This is, yeah. Yeah, that's great for branding.
I'm like, eh, it's a backpack they're developing with Samsonite. And it's the Connect with a K hyphen I backpack. There is a slim version for $199 and a standard version for $219. So it's not a JanSport, but it's not like all that crazy. So
I think it's a reasonable price.
I have a Bellroy backpack. And I don't remember how much I paid for it. I got it because it was super waterproof and I now live in Seattle. And this backpack is clean. It looks like that. Like I would buy this backpack. In fact, I might buy this backpack.
It's pretty minimal.
Okay. Not a lot to say there. Okay. So I think that's enough news and gadgets and stats for the week. So now it's time for the Internet of Things podcast hotline. That is the section of the show where we answer your questions, and it is brought to you by Schlage Encode. The Schlage Encode is a Wi-Fi connected smart lock, and Schlage wants you to know that the best home automation adds convenience, not hassle. With its built-in Wi-Fi, the Schlage Encode Smart Wi-Fi Deadbolt shows you just how easy secure can be. You can learn more at schlage.com, and I like it. I have one. I like it. And let's talk about the prize for October. Everybody who calls into the IoT podcast is entered to win a prize. This month's prize is going to be your smart speaker of choice. So you will either get a Nest Audio or a next generation, the new spherical fourth generation Amazon Echo. So
the bowling ball.
The bowling ball. Or I guess I could get you the bowling ball with panda or tiger on it if you want a smaller version. But basically, we're looking at your smart speakers of your choice. So that is the October prize. So give us a call at 512-623-7424 to ask your question and be entered to win. And now it is time for this week's question, which comes to us from Don. Don wants to protect his grandson. Let's hear it.
Hi, Stacy and Kevin. This is Don Yerkes. I'm calling in reference to my grandson is 16 months old, and we have a basement stairwell situation where if he's starting to learn how to open the doors, and I'm wondering if I used a Wyze sensor, could I somehow connect it to a Google Home where as the Wyze sensor would open up, the Google Home would then say, okay, please keep an eye on the basement door. It's open now. Something to that effect where I could connect a Wyze sensor to a Google Home as a safety element for my 16-month-old grandson. Thanks for any help with this. Love listening to the podcast. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, Don, this is a noble use of the smart home. Although I would just tell you to get a baby gate. Because I feel like you might be over-engineering this a little bit, but maybe he's a bruiser and can just like take out the gate. So we're going to answer this question for you. We think the best option, since you've got the Wyze sensor, you mentioned that, which is a good option. It's very small. There's a couple things you can do. So First up, you can connect it to a Wyze light bulb. You cannot connect it to a Google Home and have the Google Home tell you anything. That's the first. That's probably the first. What you want to do, you can't do yet.
Right, because with the Wyze app, when you set up your rules and your automations, you can only automate other Wyze products. That's the limitation there.
Yes. If you switch to a different open-close sensor, that's going to open up new possibilities, although you still won't be able to have a sensor tell Google to notify you, I don't believe. I could not find a way to do that in a routine yet. But let's talk about Wyze on Wyze first. Wyze sensor to Wyze light bulb. Kevin suggested you toggle it. I agreed with him until we watched Kevin toggle it, and then it was super fast. So if you're going to do this, you should toggle all of your lights.
Right. Make them flash maybe even a couple of times, because the one time it was just on and then off. And that's you may not see that.
If it's daylight, yeah, you may not notice that.
Right.
You'll also get a notification for the sensor on your phone. Mm-hmm. We were trying to find a way to have the Wyze sensor ping the Wyze doorbell chime, but we could not see that yet. So that is unfortunate. And the other option for you on the Wyze sensor is IFT. You can actually tie your Wyze sensor to IFT and have all kinds of things happen. We could not find a really compelling alarm sound, although there are alarm products that have sirens attached to them. I don't know if you want to do that to your grandson.
No. Maybe you want to play a song. If you have Sonos, for example, you can connect the sensor to your Sonos via IFT. I'm not sure what Don has, so it's hard to say what other products he has. So I would say look at IFT and see what products you have that are supported there. Maybe there's something that will catch your attention.
And there is one other thing. I lied to you when I said that was the final thing. The other thing you can do if you have Amazon Echo devices in your home, Madam A says, so what will happen is you'll hook up your Wyze sensor as part of this routine. And when that sensor is triggered, your Echo, and you set, it's only an Echo in one room, so you'll have to set a room that you're often in, maybe. Then that Echo will say, door opened, or whatever you want. It actually can say, you know, the aliens have landed, or go get your grandson. So those are your options that we found for you.
It would be nice if you could generate a broadcast message throughout your house, through all your smart speakers, especially with the Google Home, since you already have that, but it just does not seem possible at this time.
But with software updates,
never know.
All right. Well, if you would like to ask us a question, give us a call, 512-623-7424, and you will be entered to win the smart speaker of your choice. That's it for this segment of the show, but please stay tuned for our guest, Mike Cirelli, who is with Ecolab. He's going to be talking about using HoloLens for remote workers and building IoT sensors a quarter century ago. So, all of this and more awaits you after a word from our sponsor. Hey everyone, we are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Perceive, and I have Steve Teig, the CEO of Perceive, here to tell us about it. So Steve, tell me a little bit more about Perceive's Ergo processor.
Perceive is really about transforming sensing into perceiving, to transform the raw pixels and raw audio that you see in sensory devices into more context and understanding what is being looked at, what is being listened to. The way we provide that is through our Ergo chip, an edge processor that is the first to bring data center class analysis inside edge devices. We can run some of the largest neural networks that people run in the data center in 20 milliwatts.
So with increased performance, what type of applications does Ergo currently enable?
Well, the most obvious example might be a home doorbell camera or a home security camera, where we can tell the difference between a FedEx delivery person and your aunt coming to visit your house. On the audio side, that we can tell the difference between a dog barking and a breaking window, that we can understand our environments without the creepiness of sending your data to somebody else's cloud, but having the camera itself understand what's going on around it. This will allow state-of-the-art security, making the objects you interact with behave in the way they're supposed to by putting enough intelligence inside them to respond in a more contextually aware way.
Sounds good. So what are some features that could be coming in the future to Ergo-fitted devices?
Well, one area we're certainly focused on is voice recognition, having a richer degree of natural language processing inside an edge device. But another bolder initiative that we're pursuing is understanding not just detections of objects, but events. What's going on in the scene? Has a package been delivered versus has a package been picked up, as opposed to just detecting a package? Being able to understand what's going on in the scene. There's a car driving by, not just I photographed the car. This is the kind of intelligent processing and context awareness that Ergo can provide.
That sounds really awesome. So I know privacy is a really common consumer concern for the smart home. And how does Ergo attempt to address that?
We take privacy and security very seriously. And for privacy, the fact that all of the processing is being done inside the Ergo chip, we don't even use an external memory, means that your data doesn't have to leave our chip to go anywhere else. We avoid the creepiness that video and audio from your house is going to somebody else's cloud. That both mitigates privacy exposure, but also security risks. That is, it's much harder to hack data if it's not flying around the web somewhere.
I know you're focused on the smart home today, but are there other industries that Ergo might be a fit for?
Most definitely. We really have the grand objective of upgrading sensing to perceiving wherever sensors might be. So that's in wearables, in mobile phones, in appliances, in toys, perhaps in vehicles. Any place that you would logically put a sensor, you might as well have a sensor that understands its context, that perceives. Why would you choose just to sense raw pixels when you can understand your environment?
All right. And where can listeners go to find more about Perceive's latest offerings?
Well, the best place to start is probably our website at perceive.io.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Mike Cirilli, who is VP of Digital Marketing Strategy for Industrial Solutions at Ecolab. Hello, Mike. How are you today?
Hey, Stacey. Great. Thank you. It's good to be here.
I am excited. We're going to be talking about a couple things I love, Microsoft's HoloLens and factory automation, how IoT can help in factories, and something that I need, water. So with that in mind, let's get started by having you tell us a little bit about what Ecolab is and what it does.
Yeah, so it's not a well-known fact, but water is really used in the manufacturing and production of, you know, virtually everything we consume. Food to beverages to automotive products to the power we generate. And really the criticality of water in that process is something we're focused on as an organization. It's also really important for us, the sustainability side of that equation and the conservation of that water. And so everything we do really is intended to understand the contribution water makes to the manufacturing process, whether that's on the boiling or cooling side of the equation, and then also how we monitor the performance and quality of that water in the manufacturing environment, really to help our customers, you know, not only produce more, but do it more efficiently at a higher value.
How do your customers in the industrial side or in the food and beverage side, how do they use water in manufacturing?
Yeah, I mean, let me give you one really tangible example. I mean, we work with a large consumer goods company that, you know, is the manufacturer of ice cream. And as you would think, water is an essential ingredient, not only in the product itself, but in the manufacturing of the product. And the temperature and quality of the chemistry of that water in that process is essential to make sure that the end quality product of the right ice cream comes out the other end on the manufacturing process. So, you know, that is one small example, but, you know, in many, many, many different variant applications, water is used as a critical component of delivering a final quality product.
So how is water used in an industrial capability?
So a heavy industrial example of how water is used in the manufacturing process is, and maybe the best one is the manufacturing of paper. As you would expect, the defined requirements related to the quality of paper and the amount of water used in the process is really, really critical. And the moving and heating and cooling of that water through the process to ensure product quality, whether it's product thickness, whether it's products used and paper used to write on or boxes to ship Amazon goods, water is really essential.
Okay. So Let's talk about technology. When you guys reached out, you reached out talking about Microsoft's HoloLens, which is a headset that delivers augmented or mixed reality. And I was very curious to hear how y'all are using it with your clients.
Yeah, so I mean, digital technology has really been core to our business model. I mean, we've been fortunate. We've pioneered IoT and sensor devices on water assets in our customers' facilities for over 25 years. Those IoT devices monitor the performance and health and quality of that water. It's an incredibly complex equation, which includes our field and sales and service teams, on-site customer resources and engineers, a lot of expertise back within our headquarters around chemistry and chemistry research and really optimization of the best solution for customers. So we're really fortunate that we've had visibility remotely for some time to customers' operations and in their water systems within their manufacturing process. And where HoloLens and other remote technologies have really played an increasing role in our strategy is really a lot has to do with most recently the impact of COVID-19. I think that has really impacted companies' adoption of IoT and digital solutions and the need to do more remotely and have transparent visibility to a lot of the operating scenarios that happen within a given facility. So we're beginning to really identify a number of different use cases for different technologies like HoloLens and mixed reality solutions.
So when I think of HoloLens, I think of people who are in a factory trying to maybe troubleshoot something and they're using the data overlay to help them put things in the right place. It's usually used as a remote training kind of option. So how are people using it today at Ecolab customers or internally?
I think that's exactly right, Stacey. I mean, the technology is being used to really leverage expertise that physically isn't going to an environment or a site. And, whether it's RealWear technology or HoloLens 2, those are used on a plant floor by an employee or an Ecolab expert. And then they are connecting back with resources and expertise throughout the globe that aren't located physically with them. And it really allows them to leverage expertise, knowledge, content, and it's all being integrated at the point of contact where the technology is on the plant floor. So it's an incredible tool to help drive really efficiency, resourcing, and access to information and less time spent of experts traveling on planes and staying in hotels and having to be physically present to support a customer on their site.
And then how are y'all using HoloLens to make things easier, not just in the pandemic, but just broadly?
Yeah, so one really great example is of HoloLens is a protein plant where we trained over 60 individuals at our customers' operations within a very small window of an hour or two's time. And historically, that would have taken us over a week to do from a program perspective. So I think there's a major efficiency play that HoloLens provides us.
Any other examples?
Yeah, so one really great example of our technical service teams would be the deployment of IoT sensor equipment and technology that requires not only setup, but configuration of that hardware and those solutions. And the ability to do that remotely with HoloLens is a significant time saver. Historically, if they had to physically be in a customer's operations, they'd be able to complete 3 to 5 visits per week. We're finding now with HoloLens that they can do an excess of 10 to 12 of those similar complex activities a week. So the efficiency and productivity is multiplied by a factor of 2 or 3. So it's really been a great resource and tool for us.
Okay. And what other technology do you need to have to make something like this work? Because obviously, if I'm thinking about water, I'm thinking, you probably have to sense like the quality of the water, maybe the temperature. All of those things are not visual. And there's probably things around flow. What other technology are you using in your customers' sites?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we have an IoT sensor device that is branded called 3D Tracer. That's a chemistry dispensing IoT device. We also have access to the data that comes off of those IoT sensors that is stored in the cloud. We have a platform that aggregates that data called Ecolab 3D. And then we have a lot of applications that allow us to look at different performance and risk and value scenarios for the customer. So we're fortunate that we have a high number of connected IoT sensors, and we have a robust platform, and we have applications that give us different forms of data for us to evaluate things like water performance and quality. So those are all leverageable by the resources that are working with the HoloLens 2 technology and RealWear technology.
Okay. And as your customers are deploying these sorts of tools, where are they getting stuck? Because this is always, you know, you read so much about pilot purgatory and challenges here. And I'm curious, what are the challenges they might be encountering and how do they overcome them, or how do you help them overcome them?
Well, I think our customers, like us, are navigating the changes from COVID-19, the importance of digital tools and access to data. We continue to work with our customers on how we train not only on the use of the hardware and solutions we have, but also the value. And, you know, I think that's an area where, from a transformative perspective, you know, we're partnering with our customers to help them better understand the usage of the solution and how it can impact and help their time required to remediate and solve problems and challenges or issues they have with the system. So I would say the big one is really the ongoing training aspect.
Okay. And you mentioned sustainability, and that is a big deal for everyone. So what kind of technologies do you think, so how can the IoT help us conserve water and, you know, still have enough to use?
Yeah, I mean, it really is. That is our ethos and pretty much everything our organization focuses on, and really our purpose as a company. And really, if we look at our digital tools, they all in some way support the evaluation of water and the consumption and quality of water. The one area in particular that we have an offering is something called Water Flow Intelligence. It does exactly that. It looks to a customer's water supply from end to end and really evaluates opportunities where there may be waste or overusage in their process. And that tool alone really directly correlates to the amount of gallons of water saved in a facility at a plant. And then a lot of focus is, linked to then the sustainability and priority goals of companies that, you know, most have around water and natural resources. So I think we've got a really great competitive position.
And do you think that with the pandemic and everything that's happening there, are companies perhaps becoming overwhelmed and they're focusing more on the panic of today as opposed to a panic coming in 10 to 20 years with water sustainability? Or are they successfully juggling both?
Well, I mean, the number of companies we work have a very long-range view of the challenge. And so there's no question that, you know, the natural resource of water is top of mind in most sustainability plans for large companies we deal with. So I do feel like there's a long-range view. There's no question that, you know, the changing business climate around COVID-19 has served as an accelerator to some of those efforts and priorities as companies look to become more efficient and to ensure their supply chains aren't interrupted, and to also, you know, more aggressively go after the water savings and water consumption targets they have. So I would say that they, you know, still have a very long-term view, but are accelerating against how to deliver against that in the near term.
Oh, that's encouraging. Let's think about advice that you guys would offer, not just your customers, but anybody who's trying to deploy technology as part of their solution for their customers and even in their own operation. For example, your IoT sensor, y'all developed that 25 years ago. So you have valuable experience that other people are probably like, oh, how do you incorporate something like that into your business?
Yeah, I think there's a couple aspects to success, so to speak, in the category and space. I think the first is you have to be willing to fail and deliver a minimal viable product and solution at a fairly accelerated rate, just because the category obviously moves so quickly. So there has to be a willingness to deliver a, you know, first version R1 minimal viable product to your customer that meets a very well-defined use case. And I think that's the second part, where there is so many different means in which we can add value to customers and where technology can play. I think it's really critical that the use case is defined well, and that, you know, from insight to action to value in terms of what it provides. And I think that the final part is just having a willing collaborator across each of the dimensions, right? Willing collaborator with the customer, willing technology partner to work with, and then obviously, you know, linking those three aspects together. But I think those are the real keys to success in this digital age.
Excellent. All right. Well, Mike, thanks for coming on the show this week. I really appreciate learning more about water and how you guys are using HoloLens for remote collaboration.
Thanks, Stacey. It was great to join.
That's it for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, if you'd like more IoT news, sign up for my newsletter at stacyoniot.com. We'll see you next week.